Greetings and welcome to Moose Monday, the official podcast of the Moose Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin with Jack Spencer, Simon Schuster, Abigail Walsh, John Roerich, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, we're going to be speaking with Darwin Giles. He is the ethnic vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party. And also, we're going to be speaking with the mother of a medical marijuana patient and the impact of the medical marijuana regulation bill that passed the Senate this week and is expected to be on the House agenda later this week. But first, guys, got a few things to talk about. John, you just showed this video of Hillary Clinton getting helped into the car at the 911 commemoration ceremony, and it's been kind of the talk of the weekend here to see her physically practically being lifted into this vehicle. It's it hasn't been a very good week here for the former First Lady.
No, it hasn't, and it comes at a really bad time for her campaign. There's already been questions. I think Rudy Giuliani had an op-ed about it, raising her health as an issue. Donald Trump's raised it as an issue. The problem is so close to the election that that image is going to be played and replayed and replayed, and it shows a fairly sick Hillary Clinton. She's obviously got pneumonia that will take weeks to recover. I've had walking pneumonia, and when I was in my 20s, it took me 3 weeks to recover. I can't imagine having it at 69 and running for president.
So, Jack, what's your thoughts on this? Because this came right at the heels of her comment about the basket of deplorables, talking about the Donald Trump supporters, half of them being the basket of deplorables, racist, xenophobes, etc. What's your take on what's going on with her right now?
Well, it's kind of interesting because one of the things I watch for is how campaigns act. That sometimes tells you more about what's going on than what pundits say or anything else. And it did look like the Clinton campaign was getting a little bit desperate, acting like they were really uncomfortable last week with both Bill coming up with his statements of what Make America Great meant, and Hillary doing the basket of deplorables right afterward. Didn't seem like a well-oiled machine sort of type of comment. Actually, the kind of mistakes that we've kind of come to expect from Trump, we started seeing coming out of the Clinton campaign. Then she has this happen. I wonder what this does to the debate. Is this going to interfere with the debate schedule? There's all kinds of things involved with this thing. I don't ever remember a presidential candidate having a serious physical illness like this in the middle of a campaign. So to me, it may be kind of an unprecedented situation, at least in terms of modern presidential campaigns.
And we're taping on Monday here for MERS Monday, and we just did receive the new polling from Steve Mitchell's firm, Mitchell Research and Communications, showing that Clinton's lead is now just 5 points here in the state of Michigan, 47-42, with 11 undecided. And you throw the third-party folks in there, and it's only a six-point lead, 45-39. So,
which is half of what it was in August.
John, you were able to talk to Gary Peters a little earlier today about his thoughts on this Hillary Clinton fall. Let's just go ahead and listen to that audio.
Can you speak a little bit to what happened with her? I mean, do you think it's going to affect the race as far as her pneumonia or kind of falling yesterday?
I doubt it. It will. Hopefully she'll just take care of herself. You know, when you think about what our presidential candidates go through,
it's amazing.
It is a grind. And to think the hours they put in, the stress they are under, the amount of people they see and the hands that they shake, and it's natural that sometimes your body gets ill, so you just need to get better. In fact, in some ways, I'm surprised our candidates don't get ill more because it's really, really pretty intense experience. We put whoever our presidential candidates are, we put them through a real grinder in the campaign.
All right, let's talk about another story going closer statewide. Steve Marino apparently was taped by some Democratic tracker, allegedly bragging about how when he was a lobbyist, he picked up the bar tab for a former state lawmaker. He's now saying that his comments were miscategorization, so he's trying to walk that back. What's the significance of this, Abby?
This race has been near the top of our top 15 for a while now. It's a 50-50 district, and Dana Camphouse Peterson has a relationship with a very popular county executive in Mark Hackle. This is just not quite an October surprise for the Moreno campaign, but getting pretty close.
I mean, this is obviously not good news here because it makes it look like in the lobbying realm that he was basically doing something unseemly, and now he's walking it back. So now the Democrats got him in this pickle, where he's either some lobbyist who's fleecing lawmakers or he's a liar.
So, yeah, I mean, I think he was in a tough position as a candidate, a former lobbyist in Lansing. And I think, you know, maybe the play here was trying to distance himself by being different from this crew. But, yeah, he's now in a tight position.
Jack, give me your perception as a former House reporter. How big of an impact could this have on Steve Marino's bid for the state House, if any?
Well, I think it highlights that he's a former lobbyist, and this is not the year for a former lobbyist. I would think that's a strike against anybody going into the situation. And, of course, you talk about Macomb County. You've probably got 100 different offshoots of this that we haven't even thought of yet. I would say probably anything like this that's negative is a good thing for the Democrats to be hitting on, and it just brings right there in focus and great big headlines. This guy is a former lobbyist. Is this really who you want to vote for?
And this also maybe just piles onto the skepticism of Lansing in general and this kind of salacious idea that lawmakers and lobbyists have a back-scratching environment up here, a kind of a pay-to-play. And this is obviously seems like a pretty large example of lobbyists picking up the tabs for lawmakers. You know, it's something that if you want to explore, if you want to pull that thread, I don't think that there would be any shortage of examples of lobbyists paying for lawmakers or staffs, lunch, dinner, parties, what have you.
Yeah, I think that beyond anything related to the optics of employment history, when you are a new candidate and you're seeking an office for the first time, you want to show yourself as a person of change, someone who's coming at this from a different perspective. But instead, if you find yourself in a position where the veil is lifted and that you are playing the same old, you know, somewhat amoral political game that everyone admittedly plays, that's not the sort of image you want to broadcast.
Well, the Democrats are going to continue on this theme. They're holding a press conference today on this matter. They've launched a website about Steve Marino. I'm sure this is not going to be the last time that we've heard about that. Over the weekend, Simon, we had a story in MERS about putting a price tag on the city of Flint's water crisis. And this was a story that you've spent some time on. And what we found out at the end was that there is no price tag that the administration, the Snyder administration, is releasing publicly. Good or bad?
Well, I think that's a question of your perspective. If you're a resident of Flint, if you're, you know, in Genesee County or on the municipal staff, you know, this is a bad thing because if you don't have a price tag on it, you don't know how much commitment is needed to resolve this problem. Of course, other people like Congressman Dan Kildee, the city of Flint itself, and even the administration previously have put estimates on some of the damages, but that's not all come out yet.
Jacob, what's your impression on this? Because obviously there's a good government perspective on this and whether you should have a price tag on Flint so you can dedicate the necessary resources over time. And then there's the political and the optics, because once you start putting numbers on the Flint water crisis, then you not only own it, but you're expected to pay for it ultimately. You kind of put the state on the hook.
Yeah, I mean, the first part makes sense, right? Like you want to plan, you want to, you know, the state budgets every year, you want to have an idea of what things cost and what you pay for it. But with something as large as the Flint water crisis, I think it starts to get a little problematic with how you put a final singular number on it. And I think that's where the political side gets into it. And we put it out there a little bit ago before. If you put a number on it, you know, you shoot too low, you don't make up to it. And if it go past it, then, you know, you spend too much. And there's so many other consequences tied to it as well. The state's already being sued. But again, that's another liability concern is we put that number on it. Oh, then that's what the parties want out of civil suits.
That's a good point. And it's, what makes it harder, though, is we've got our CPA governor who's made his mantra about putting price tags on certain long-term liabilities, whether it's health care and retirement benefits for state employees or school employees, and then, let's say, the credits that were given to the manufacturing sector back in the Granholm era, putting a price tag on what those benefits are going to cost well into the future. It's all about putting numbers on something, but then, John, he doesn't want to put a number on this.
It is such an enormous issue, though. It's so hard to even fathom a number, but I'm surprised that they don't have at least a sort of a baseline. All right, from a state perspective, looking at infrastructure and some educational support, let's think about $1 billion, or let's think about $800 million, or whatever the number might be.
It always kind of seems like whenever you put a number on something of this magnitude, it's only going to get higher, right? It never gets lower.
And you don't want to start the bidding either.
And I think that moving forward, this is the way we're going to see this debate framed, especially as we approach funding battles in the future, because I think we've made it evident now that this is not a problem that's going to be resolved in 1, 2, or 3 budget cycles. It's going to be 5, 10, and 20 years. And what you're seeing from the academic world is people putting a number on the social cost of the Flint water crisis, how much it'll cost for these lower rates of high school graduation and these reduced overall economic achievements that the residents of Flint will face as a result of their lead exposure. And so the arguments that many people are making now is that the more money that you put in now in early childhood education and things of these sort, the more costs down the road you're going to head off.
And again, if you don't put a number on there, there's the risk that you don't hit any of those things that you're talking about, Simon, right? I mean, these numbers on the social costs of Flint water, if you don't enumerate that, there's a potential that you just don't hit them altogether. But then if you do put a number on it, then you kind of hamstring the administrations that come after you, that if they don't hit that, then all of a sudden they look like a failure too, right? So if Schuette or Callie comes in later and, well, Snyder's administration said it was 1.5, you're only spending an average of $500 million, whatever, right? So then you're setting expectations going into the future. And if you haven't read the story yet in MERS, we're going to put it on our Facebook page a little later today. So folks who are listening to this podcast, if you haven't read it, on the MERS Capital Capsule, it will be available on our Facebook page.
All right, joining us now for the podcast, we're speaking with Ida Shinonis. She is of Grand Blanc, and she has a daughter who has been a beneficiary of medical marijuana. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk first of all about your daughter, Bella. She's 7 years old. How long has she been using medical marijuana? And give us a little history on how this happened, that you guys stumbled upon it and began using it.
Okay. She's actually been on it now for a little over a year and a half. Back in January, a couple years ago, she had gone through a weekend of seizures. She seized morning through night the entire weekend. Upon calling Ann Arbor, I had the choice of writing it out or bringing her in for more medications. And I kept going back to the interview I saw on TV with Dr. Sanjay Gupta about medical marijuana. And I thought, okay, how do I get a hold of this? What do I do? And I had learned at that time that I had a cousin who was working for Iron Labs. And so I contacted her, and she put me in contact with what I needed to do to get our cards and get her all set up to start receiving the medicine.
Obviously, when we think about medical marijuana, we think of smoking it. But obviously, being only 7 years old, she's not going to be smoking it. So how is it administered?
It's actually made into an oil as an extract, and she gets it 3 times a day. We rotate different oils. Only one of them has THC in it with CBD, and then the other two are strictly CBD oils, and we have to rotate them in order to keep her seizure-free.
What's your experience been with it since she's been on it? How has her physical conditions changed?
It has been completely mind-blowing. When we first started the journey, I asked her teachers just to keep an eye on her in school. I told them that we were starting a new medication. I just didn't tell them what. And I said the same thing to her bus drivers. And within a week, they all were contacting me wanting to know what she was on because the change in just a week's time was so tremendous. Her eye contact is phenomenal. You can call her name now and she will turn and look directly at you. She is trying to mouth words. She's nonverbal, but you can see that she's actively trying to move her mouth to get words out, which is really cute. She's actually been able to weight bear for the first time in 7 years. We went to physical therapy for her, and she was actually standing up on her own, weight bearing, which is a really good positive motivation, you know, to keep doing what we're doing.
Wow. And so prior to this, she had, can you estimate how many seizures that she had before the medical marijuana and how many she's having now?
Yeah, it before the medical marijuana, it ranged. It could go anywhere from a couple times a day. We'd have a couple months free. Her longest seizures were 27 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And side effects, unfortunately, from the pharmaceutical medications have caused her to go into stage 1 renal failure. You know, she already has holes in her heart. So we already have a complicated medical history that I really do not want to increase if I don't have to.
Right. And so since she's been able to be on the medical marijuana, what's the seizures like?
She right now is seizure free. So when she has breakthrough seizures, it's because she either is in a UTI and she's in severe pain, or she has a fever and it's a febrile seizure. But with starting the medical marijuana in the beginning, the seizures, you could see that the duration, they would start to decrease. They would be range from any time from 10 seconds to 2 minutes, and they were not as severe. She does have grand mal seizures, so it's the full body, it's the tonic-clonic. And it's a horrific sight to watch your child have to go through.
Oh, God, I can't even imagine. The Senate has just passed some regulations that will change how medical marijuana is distributed in the state. How do you guys receive it now?
We work with some guys down in Detroit, Nature's Alternative, and I just drive down once a month and pick it up from them.
And so under this legislation, it would regulate it more uniformly across the state, and so the chances of you being able to receive it locally will definitely go up, I'm sure.
Yes, I'm sure it would.
Just as far as the Senate getting around to passing this this legislation and allowing for its regulation, just kind of give me your reaction on them being able to get this passed, get it back to the House where it's expected to be concurred in, and sent to the governor.
I'm excited that they're actually listening to the patients and hearing about these children's lives. It's refreshing to know that, we are having people in our corners and they're understanding our story and wanting to get her the help that she needs.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. We've been speaking with Ida Shinonis. She's from Grand Blanc and speaking about her experience with getting medical marijuana for her daughter. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you, Kyle.
Joining me on the other end of the line is the ethnic vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party. It is Darwin Giles. Thanks for joining us in the podcast today.
Thank you and good morning. It's a pleasure and it's an honor always.
Well, let's talk about the Flint water situation. I know that is a subject that is very important to you. And first of all, just explain to our listeners why Flint is so important to you.
Flint is so important to me. Not only is it my hometown, but actually in 2008, my father was a victim of a homicide, in which I feel indebted to my city, also to honor my father, to really stand against the culture of corruption that we've had there, whether it be the street culture or the culture of corruption within City Hall, that I fought against the former Mayor Dane Walling and supported individuals, in the past, such as Woodrow Stanley and also Don Williamson as former mayors there to stand up and do all I can within my strength, within my power to help better the city, not only for the future of the city, but also for the youth there who needs direction and examples to stand up for truth. So that's part of my true passion for Flint, Michigan.
How do you think Karen Weaver is doing in regards to this, to defeating or to scale back this culture of corruption that you've seen historically?
Without a doubt, I know Karen Weaver holds the power and the skill set to do the right thing. And Flint, I also helped get her elected. I endorsed the Karen Weaver. However, there's going to be challenges within this particular type of city that's been ran by corruption for so long. One thing is being Karen is going to have a very authentic and individualistic approach to her governing there and her leadership towards the city and far as working with city council members. She's going to have to use her PhD and all of her educational knowledge and skill set she's developed over the years to stand as an individual for the city and not be so caught or indebted to her political advisors, those who helped get her elected, whether it be my Uncle Charles Winfrey or former Mayor Woodrow Stanley. These are all individuals who I know have tried to do their best within the city. However, there is some conflict of interest there, and it's very important that if Karen Weaver wants to continue doing a good job, that she's going to have to stand up and let individuals know that, hey, she can do the job and that she can also be neutral and very objective.
Now, you just mentioned a conflict of interest. What are you referring to?
I'm referring to particularly her political advisors. She has a set of political advisors that I think who could be a conflict of interest to the city to a large extent, whether it be backdoor deals or special interests that they could kind of co-op or influence her into. I think Karen Weaver's intentions is not to get caught up in this type of mess. However, again, being that this has been a culture of corruption for a long, long time, it's very easy to do so. I mean, this is politics.
Now, how do you think she's done as far as managing the pipe replacement and the water crisis in general?
The water crisis in general, I think, between Republican lawmakers in Flint and Democratic lawmakers, both sides being responsible, I believe, should have worked better for the best interests of the people. I think Karen Weaver has tried to do her best, but again, steering clear of politics to get this thing done right, it's going to be a huge challenge, and I think that she needs to do better in that area, because if not, it's going to be seen as a political football just thrown around to fit the whatever political interest of whatever party or individual or politician, and we don't need to do that. However, she does have a heart for Flint, and she has a heart to care for the people in Flint, and I don't doubt that. I think she actually has a great opportunity to do what no other mayor or politician has really done in Flint, which is to honestly care for the people and make legitimate decisions and be objective, being that she's not an original politician coming in. I mean, and she has a very good skill set. She's very intelligent. So anybody thinks otherwise, it really is not, you know, they're not familiar with Karen Weaver. They're not painting her accurately, because she's a very smart and intelligent person. However, steering clear of politics and the culture of corruption is going to be a huge task.
Now, one of the subjects that has come up that Joe Gray, state representative, has brought up is that there's a company in California that is willing to supply plastic pipes for the city of Flint, and Karen Weaver has pushed back on that, and even though the pipes would be for free, she's concerned about their safety. What's your opinion on her position on that?
Well, I've done some research on that, and I'm still doing more. I think that would be a very good observation, and I think a case study needs to be done with any company that's willing to do a job and do it correctly. However, we need to make sure that that is not a recommendation of our political advisors pressing her so hard in that, because this is the thing. Any decision Karen Weaver makes, even if it's someone else influencing her to do it, she's going to go down in history as being the individual who's made these decisions when we could have done different things for the city. So I would caution anybody to make hash decisions or rash decisions concerning these types of situations, but also to be clear of every alternative that we can have there. And I think Juantuez Davis, the actual Fifth Ward council member, has did a really good job at pointing that out, of trying to look at other alternatives. However, he's went about it, I think, in a very disrespectful manner or tone at times. He's even promised to tone that down since his recent legal issues. And he's promised to stay clear and neutral of just trying to help Karen Weaver and to make better decisions as a council member. So I just really think that all alternatives need to be on the table. I really do.
One last question I wanted to ask you about. Last time we had you on the podcast, you were critical of Donald Trump. Have you decided what you're going to do in the presidential race yet?
Absolutely not. I mean, this thing is still changing nearly almost by the week. So by the looks of it, I can say Donald Trump looks like he can win the actual White House. And it's going to look even harder for Hillary. However, I'm not really going to make any type of decision concerning the presidential election.
All right. Darwin Giles, he is the ethnic vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Darwin Giles and also Jen Flood from Dykema for getting us our interview a little earlier, with Ida Chinois from Grand Blanc. Also, thanks to Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, Abigail Walls, and John Rurink and Jack Spencer. I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.